Hey everybody, Scruffy Fern here, back with another quick video. Actually, we're live today. We're going to be chatting about some really cool topics around legal and game design. And in fact, I'm being joined live from Ottawa via Skype with Brian Pasco and Mark Edwards from Edwards PC Creative Law. And they're going to discuss with us some of the issues that you're kind of faced on the legal side of things when you're getting into game development and trying to publish games. So joining me live via Skype from Ottawa is Brian Pasco and Mark Edwards. They are from Edwards PC Creative Law. So why don't you guys do a quick little intro and we'll jump into the question.
I'm Mark Edwards and this is Brian Pasco, and we're with Edwards PC Creative Law, Ottawa and Toronto Entertainment Law Company. And as the name, or as that description indicates, we are Ottawa-based lawyers, or Ontario-based lawyers, and so we practice Ontario and Canadian law. And so for those of you who are outside of Ontario or outside of Canada, what we'll be discussing today may have some application to you, but it also you may find that there are differences in the law in other jurisdictions. The other thing we should say is that the nature of legal advice is that it's the application of law to a specific set of circumstances. So because we're not addressing specific circumstances here, what we're discussing today isn't legal advice. And obviously, if you're in need of legal advice, I encourage you to seek it out. But anyway, we hope that what we talk about today will give you some sense of the context, the legal context in which you are producing and exploiting your games.
Absolutely. I know in my own personal experience, one of the hardest things is really getting a grasp and understanding the legal consequences and issues that you're going to be faced when you start producing games and working with publishers and doing contracts and whatever it might be. So to get us started, one of the biggest questions that I have, and I know a lot of others have reached out in the past, is around IP. So specifically around copyrights. So what do I need to get a copyright? What is a copyright? And what does copyright protection afford me?
Okay, that's a good question. Intellectual property is a very, very important part of game production and exploitation. It's what gives you the opportunity to to claim ownership and then to monetize or to generate revenue from the game, and the key element of the intellectual property in game development is what's called copyright. And so copyright is this: it's the rights that the creator of a work, and in this case the video game is the work, has when they create something that is original and that involves the exercise of some skill and judgment. And obviously video game does involve considerable skill and judgment, and if you're the creator, it would be original to you. So now the interesting thing about copyright is, although you can register copyright, and we encourage you to register copyright, it exists in the moment of creation. So copyright is when an idea is given tangible form. So it ceases to be merely an idea, and it's written down, or it's sketched, or it's played. It's given a tangible form. So for example, code is copyright as a they call it a literary work. It's a written work. But the game itself is a compilation of written and of graphic and musical elements, and that as a single entity is also a copyright work. So when you create your game, it is copyright. It has you own the copyright in that game. But by registering it, and in Canada you can do that online through the Canadian Intellectual Property Office, you get certain advantages. The most significant of which is that instead of the burden being on you to demonstrate that you are the copyright owner of your game, the burden shifts on someone who's challenging that. So if you're the registered copyright holder, presumptively you are the copyright owner, and so someone who's challenging that has the burden of showing that's in fact not correct. So you have these procedural advantages. It's very cheap and simple to do it, $50 to $65 to register a copyright in Canada. So we recommend that you do that.
Yeah, that's actually really cheap. I didn't realize it was that inexpensive. One other thing that you mentioned there too is that this copyright enacts automatically. That was something that I was actually surprised to hear. So when you say it interacts or takes action immediately when you do the creation, is that the creation of the code itself? Or if I'm doing a document, say something like a GDD or a TDD, does that outline give me that protection?
Written work is, you know, you have the copyright in it. In other words, you have the exclusive right to reproduce it, to use it, to exploit it, to publish it. So, typically people don't. We write things all the time, or we create written documents all the time for which we don't really need to consider copyright. On the other hand, if somebody were to come along and take that piece of paper and walk away with it and reproduce it, we would have a basis for complaining, and that would be that we owned the copyright in that writing. So remembering, of course, that it's not the idea itself that is the copyright or in which you have copyright, it's the expression and the record of that idea. So it's the particular manner in which the idea is expressed. So that's why these things have to be reduced to a tangible form. Your idea about a particular character and the look of that character has to actually be reduced to a drawing or a design. Your idea about the game function has to be reduced to a document or to a game that actually demonstrates or expresses that idea. But at that point, if it's a game doc that you've written down, you would own the copyright in that.
Very cool. So how would I go about proving the authenticity of said document or code? Like, how would I prove that I created it before the other person?
Well, there's lots of ways of doing that. I mean, it really becomes a question of fact. Typically we have these things are done on computer. We have computer records which timestamp things. You know, in the old days, people used to take a script in the film or television context and send themselves a script in a stamped envelope and not open the envelope. There are there are repositories or places you can send your documents or your creations so that others have copies of them and can verify the time and place at which they were created. Again, back to my primary point though, the easiest way to do that is to register the copyright. In Canada, you don't have to actually deposit or give a copy of the thing to the Copyright Office. If you register your copyright in the United States, they actually require you to, if it's a script, give a copy of the script. If it's a game, provide a copy of the game. Now that's really quite definitive, because if you've registered your copyright, for example, in the United States, and you've provided a copy of that game, very, very difficult for somebody to argue that they created, or that you didn't create that thing on that day. There are a variety of ways, but it ultimately comes down to evidence. The advantage of registering is that the presumption, the courts will assume first that you are the copyright holder because you registered, and the other, the challenger, would have to prove otherwise.
Very, very cool. So if I wanted to, say, maybe incorporate something similar to another game, or my game mechanics or idea was very similar to someone else's, what kind of legal issues am I facing?
Well, I guess to take a step back, it goes back to the idea or the expression of the idea. If Party A creates a game that expresses a certain idea, let's say it's a car game and it's a racing car game, if you do a racing car game, just the idea of doing a racing car game doesn't infringe their copyright. If however, you are copying the same style and the same, you're directly copying the cars and the track, that's infringement. You're doing something that only the original copyright holder, in this case Party A, can do. So what you want to watch out for is, if you want to produce a game that's similar to something else, think about what the idea is. You can create a game with a similar idea, but don't express it in the same way as another game that's out there. There are millions of games, and you know there are many ways to express the idea of a car racing game. Just don't copy what someone else is exactly doing.
Very cool. So I could make my own platformer, but I shouldn't make it an Italian plumber. Is basically what you're getting at. Okay, very, very cool.
I mean, that's it. I mean, basically, you know, the thing is, you know, sometimes law is not as complicated as people think it is. We kind of get what it means to copy somebody else's work, right? I mean, we have a natural sensitivity to copying other people's work. And as Byron says, you know, you see a certain game mechanic, you know, the car race as an example, and but you think, wow, I can do this way cooler. I can do, like, my cars will look better, my track will look better. I've got a few ideas about how the gameplay should work, and it's a different game. You're not copying the game, so you're expressing the same idea, but in a completely different way.
Now, it's possible for two people to come up with the exact same expression. Two people can create the exact same game. And it's not copyright infringement because you're not copying the other person.
It's highly unlikely.
But, I mean, in other contexts, it's more realistic. In games, you're not going to have two of the exact same games.
Yeah.
But if you created a game, and then you see someone else who created a game, and you think, this is exactly what I did, you know, their argument is, I never saw your game. I didn't copy your game. I created this on my own. So, you know, that's where, you know, a variety of other fact-specific scenarios come into play.
Okay, that makes sense. So copyrights handle the idea, but so for my character, say my Italian plumber named Mario, how do I protect him?
So there's another area of intellectual property that becomes involved in, and that's the idea of trademark. So trademark, like copyright, exists before you register or without registration. And copyright, trademark at common, in what's it called, the common law, is essentially this. It is the creation of a link between you as the creator or source of the game and the copyright element. So let's say the name of the game. It could be the appearance of a character, the name of a character. You know, you call it, so the Italian plumber. I mean, I'd argue that the Italian plumber is a trademark of that game. Why is it a trademark of that game? It's a trademark because, although an Italian plumber is literally just a plumber from Italy or Italian origin, there's what's called a secondary meaning. That is, people connect the Italian plumber with the specific game created by Nintendo, or you know, who were the original creators? I don't know who has the
Nintendo company. Was. Yeah, you got
Nintendo,
it.
Yeah. So the point is, it's because the use of that name, that phrase, has acquired this secondary meaning, and there's a connection in the public between. Nintendo was the creator of this unique game and the phrase Italian plumber, that it's a trademark. Now you can in turn register that, and just like copyright, when you register it, you have certain advantages. The key advantage being the burden of proof, or the challenger to your copyright has to demonstrate that in fact it's not a trademarked phrase, Italian plumber, but So there are certainly advantages to registering the trademark, but the trademark exists. You know, as soon as you use that trademark often enough in a, within a certain community so that people generally associate it with you.
A couple other comments are that trademark registration is much more expensive than copyright registration, and trademark registration covers, provides you national protection, whereas trademark protection without registration covers you or provides a scope of protection in the geographical region in which your trademark is known and in which you use your trademark.
That makes sense. Like basically, if you have the funds and are able to do it, it makes sense to register, just like the copyright. It gives you those extra protections that will come in handy down the road, I'm sure.
Yeah. Now you don't copyright every element of the game. I mean, you just copyright the thing that, you know, that it would drive you crazy, and cause confusion among your fans and buyers or users. If somebody else were to use the same logo or the same name or the same character name as you, so you're picking really just the key or the key identifying elements are the only things that you would bother trademarking. The things that really have value. It's like brand. I mean, it's really, trademark is just another. I mean, it's a legal form for brand.
Makes sense. Okay. So we have one question actually coming in from chat, which is pretty good here. It's asking, so if I have a game that appears like a particular RPG, I can use similar interfaces that the original RPG uses. I just can't make it similar with the characters. I can't use the same character names and exact weapon names and stuff like that. Is that correct?
You know, so this is a very hard thing to describe in the abstract, because there's no, as you can imagine, there's no easy way to say, hey, this is a copy of something else. There was a Supreme Court case in Canada recently involving an animation series, and you know, there's three levels of judgments, and they all looked at, you know, they looked at the original drawings of the characters, they looked at, you know, the fact that the cast of characters involved, you know, whatever it was, a doctor, a lawyer, a dentist, and the descriptions of the characters, so their mannerisms and personalities, and then, you know, how they were assembled. And, you know, one level of court said, this doesn't look like a copy to us. It's not enough. Not enough has been taken from the original concept that was pitched to this animation company. And another level of court said there is enough there that we can find overall that this is a copy of the original concept, of the realization of that concept. So, you know, I'm really hesitant to give advice on what you can do and what specific elements you can copy and get away with it, and others that you cannot. All I can say is the more that you take from somebody else, the less you create that's unique yourself, the greater the risk you're going to run. So, it's a creative industry that we're in. My both legal and layman advice would be, you know, try to be as creative as you can in what you're doing, make it your own. And I don't know. I good question from the, you know, your chat line, but I'm hesitant to start defining things that will cross the line and things that won't. Yeah, because it really is, you got to look at the overall package, the starting point and the end point, and is there enough that's the same that somebody can say that it's a copy?
Yeah, that's some really good advice, right? Just be creative as you can. Avoid trying to take as much as you can from someone else. And yes, it makes sense. Each case is going to have unique reasons as to why it may or may not be infringement.
Right.
Awesome. So I think that's a really good knowledge around IP, and I think you've kind of solidified some of it with me as well. One other thing that I know as an indie developer we have a lot of trouble with is when we start to work in teams. Especially when you start thinking about, you know, copywriting things and who has ownership of what, how do contracts work and stuff like that. So basically, what's the, what's the term chain of title, and how is it related to game, to
sure.
the game?
Well, in regards to your team, you want to capture all of the rights that everyone has put in from the inception to the final product. So you want to gather those rights together, and the term chain of title is in regards to that unbroken series of transfer of rights from the creators to the company that owns the game. And there are various reasons why you want to have what's called a clean chain of title or a clear chain of title. Because when you're dealing with people external to your team, you want to be able to demonstrate that you, being you as the principal or your company who has all the rights, because they don't want people later on to say, oh, I was involved, but I didn't actually provide my rights to the company. One example is that, one very practical example is that if you're having your game published on Steam, for example, you don't want some person who contributed some art to contact Steam and say, oh, I was a part of this project, they didn't pay me, I didn't give my rights. You know, what's Steam going to do? They'll drop your game, or whoever, the publisher or distributor is not going to want to have to deal with people that are indicating that this game on their platform and that they're distributing doesn't actually have the rights, like all the rights in the game.
So when gathering those rights and trying to work that out with all the people on your team, when do you start to bring contracts into the mix?
Earlier the better. I mean, there's a difference between, and we can get into it, if you're an employee or a contractor of the company. But one basic document that can be used, or we refer to it as an assignment of rights, where the person is saying, these are my rights, I'm assigning them to the company, I'm waiving my moral rights, I'm giving my rights in the intellectual property I create to the company. And the earlier you do that kind of, the earlier you take those steps, the better. Because especially before you pay someone who's being involved to help produce your game. But just to your question of the timing, earlier the better. The later it can get more complicated, someone might leave on bad terms. You don't want to have to deal with someone who's left your group who didn't assign their rights in the game to your company.
So here's some very practical advice, right? An assignment of rights can be literally three sentences long. You don't have to have a 26-page contract, and we sometimes tell this, particularly early stage game developers, get a stack of these things with blank, two or three sentences, basically, I hereby assign all my rights in the whatever discussions we've had and creative concepts that I may have provided or designs or whatever it is that I've done. To you as the individual, Mickey who's building the game or Mickey's company, and I waive my moral rights, and you sign it and date it and you're done. This should be an ongoing process, because what happens is people walk in and they say, I've been brainstorming this with people all over the place. We've been doing this for 2 or 3 years. Who knows? There's people all over the place who contributed to the game in one way or another, long gone. Maybe forgotten, and you got a very, very messy chain of title. Now, these people may never come back at you, but it's a risk, and you can avoid the risk by starting very early, just saying, look, people, we'd love to have your contribution to the game, but I need to make sure that if we move forward, I have the rights to produce the game and to exploit the game. So, which gets into the kind of the two key elements and the two key situations. If you want to move into that now, Mickey.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd like to hear a little bit different. So you mentioned different contracts, right? And we're kind of talking about the chain of title and that. But right. Moving outside of that, when you're talking not just about rights but about work and NDAs, like non-disclosure agreements, and rights to work outside, or, you know, if I left the company and decided to go build another game company, how do, you know, independent developers go about handling situations like that?
Well, let me come back to the NDA issue for just a sec, because I think what you're touching on here as well is this distinction between an employer-employee relationship and independent contractors. Now, this is interesting. This, I hope, is very, very practical advice. You know, some of the stuff's a little bit theoretical, but this is really practical stuff. There's two ways really to get work done generally in the industry. There's employees, so the bigger companies tend to have lots of employees. Smaller companies and independents generally have use a lot of freelancers or independent contractors. Big difference between those two relationships, and here's why. Under the Copyright Act, an employee creates intellectual property for the employer, and by default, under the Copyright Act, the employer owns the product of the employee's work. So employees create copyright or intellectual property that is owned by the employer. Not so with an independent contractor. Most people don't know this, but they enter into an independent contractor agreement with, let's say, a designer, a developer, a coder, and that person does the work. They get paid for it. Guess who owns that work? The contractor owns the work.
Hmm.
That's a big surprise to a lot of people. But under the Copyright Act, unless the copyright in that intellectual property is actually transferred, the independent contractor still owns at least the copyright in it. There may have been an implied license to the game developer, to you, Mickey, in my example, or Mickey's company, to use that, but the copyright still rests with the independent creator. So you've got to have the assignment of rights document. Now, so that's, I hope, one useful piece of advice. So isn't it easier all the time just to have something in writing, whether someone's an employee or a contractor, assigning the rights? But the second interesting thing, and I'll let Byron describe this, is that it's not just about the copyright. There's another set of rights that we also have to deal with.
Well, there's moral rights.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you're talking about that. Two aspects of moral rights are the rights of attribution and the rights of integrity. And the rights of attribution are that you can have your name or another name attached to the product, and the rights of integrity relate to not, in so many words, not making you look bad, but the point is that this set of rights doesn't get transferred automatically if you transfer your intellectual property, and they can't even be transferred at all, but what they can be is waived. And so the general terms are is that this independent contractor agrees to waive their moral rights in association with the game, and that takes care of the moral rights. But if you don't have that sort of language, the issue is that let's say the graphic artist comes back and says, I don't think that I don't like the way you use my work. It looks badly on me, and I'm not, because I haven't waived my moral rights. I'm going to cause you some distress. Basically, they may go to the publisher again, as I was talking about before, and kind of, you know, raise a stink that would just would cause you lots of lost sleep. So the point is that from the outset, you want to make sure that your contractor or your employee, just to be sure, assigns their intellectual property rights and waives their moral rights.
Yeah, I think that's the best advice there is basically, yeah, just regardless if they're an employee, if they're coming in as a contractor, just have them do all this, right?
Yeah, it's very easy. And then you just got a file folder in your, you know, whatever, you've just got this, you know, series of 20 or 30 one-sheet assignments and waivers of moral rights. I mean, those moral rights are really quite... most people don't even know they exist, but when someone creates a work and they have this right of integrity, it just means that you can't really change that. So if you take an assignment of someone's game concept and then you tweak it and you twist it and you change it and you rework it and it's still their game concept, but you fundamentally changed it, you know, unless you've got a waiver of moral rights, they can come along and say, hey, you know, I don't like what you did with my concept. You can't do that to my concept. You've got to leave, you know, you've got to use it as it is. You can't modify it. Well, you can't make a game that way. So you can't make anything that way. Film, television, you've got to be able to realize your creative vision, pulling together the work of many people and shaping it in a way that you think works. So assignment of rights, waiver of moral rights for everybody.
The other comment here is that none of this really matters if your game doesn't go anywhere. People aren't going to come after you if there's no money that the game has generated. But what we like to talk about is plan for success. You want your game to be successful. You want to make a lot of money with your game. And so you don't want to get to a point later on where you've generated a lot of funds and you haven't done these simple things from the outset. But again, if nothing happens with your game, then it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. Because no one's going to come after you.
No, it's really good advice. Like, you know, you can get into a lot of legal hot water in a lot of these areas. So, yeah, just protect yourself. Like you said, it's a few documents in a file folder somewhere.
Right. And you're planning for success. I mean, you got to make the assumption. I mean, why do it? You got to make the assumption that, you know, this is going to be a great game and this is going to be a successful game. And if it is a great game and a successful game and you haven't, you haven't taken care of business along the way, you're wide open for trouble.
I'd like to think that none of us start building a game without planning on it being successful, but
that's what people say. They say, hey, this is going to be a great game. It's going to be a successful game. But they actually don't do the things that they need to do to ensure that they will enjoy that success.
Mm-hmm.
So, I say, yes, you think you're planning for success, but actually, you're really assuming this is never going to be an issue, which really... You know, another way of putting that is you're assuming it's going to be, like the stone in the middle of the lake. It's just going to drop unheard and unseen.
Mm-hmm.
And so nobody's ever going to challenge you on the rights because it's not worth it. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing there. So
not a good assumption to make, that's
no,
for sure.
No, not a good assumption.
We have a really good question. I don't know if you guys can answer this because, like you mentioned, you guys primarily focus on Canada and Ontario. But we got a question from the UK, and he said he's planning on basically making a product to release to other people overseas. In your estimation, would it be a good idea for him to register a US trademark, considering that covers more of the world, or is there any advice you can give him on that?
Well, it's a trademark convention, so registration of trademark in a country in that's a signatory to are we talking trademark or copyright?
Trademark.
Trademark. So trademark is really about every single jurisdiction. I'm sorry, I thought we were talking copyright. So, trademark. You really have to look at what your primary markets are. As Byron said earlier, registering trademarks can be relatively expensive, certainly more expensive than the copyright. And so you're looking at your primary markets. You know if the U.S. is going to be a big market, you probably want to protect your trademark there. Obviously your home jurisdiction if you're going to be you're planning to release there. Other big markets, Germany, whatever, Asia, wherever they think they're going to have the most success. You know, one of the things you can do as well is you can roll it out over time. So, pick a couple of major markets in which you're going to release in. You get some traction and it starts to become a success. Suddenly, the issue of spending $1,000 to register a trademark. It's not such a big deal anymore, if you're starting to monetize the game and it looks like it's going to be successful. So, you do have to register in each of the markets, because remember the original comment about trademark. It's about the association in people's mind. It's reputation. It's about the link between your product and you as the developer or producer. So, those are dependent on specific geographic areas. So, yeah, he's going to have to register in multiple countries, and so he's got to pick and choose which ones are most important to him.
Makes sense. And, yeah, like you said, as he expands, he can look at different markets to expand into,
over
right?
Time.
Yeah, very, very good advice. Okay, so we've taken a look at the IP around our game. We've kind of locked down the legal side of working with our team. Now, if I'm a developer and I want to, say, take that next step and go and work with another company, maybe to do some work on a game or work with a publisher, are there certain things that I should watch out for? Are there guidelines to working with companies like that?
Well, I guess one answer relates to doing service work. And so if your game company is going to be doing some service work for another entity, there are a variety of considerations with that type of agreement. They include that you want to have a strong statement of work that clearly defines the scope of the agreement. You're going to want to define who owns what rights in the actual product you're producing. Regarding fees, you want to make sure that the payment schedules are realistic. And something about that is that you can leverage the intellectual property there. If you're giving the intellectual property to the other party, you can say that the intellectual property isn't transferred until you're paid. You should talk about delivery to make sure that it's clear and attainable. Delays, talk about what automatically might cause a delay in delivery. Maintenance, what sort of warranties are being provided.
Change requests often come up.
Yep. Yeah, you want to make sure that for change requests there's a very clear process for how you deal with the other party requesting a change from you, relating both to the time to provide a quote to make that change, and just kind of generally speaking to make it clear that changes will cost money, and if they want to change, this is what it'll cost to make that change. Indemnification, if you're getting, let's say, a logo from this other party and you're making a game or a website, you want to make sure that if that logo infringes the copyright or trademark of someone else, that the party you're dealing with covers you. So they're indemnifying you in case your use of something you receive is offside. So those are some elements of a service agreement that you would want to think about if you're doing work for a third party.
Can I add one more comment, Mickey, on that? And all of those are very, very important things in terms of a service deal and variations of those if they're co-production deals or co-development deals, joint venture deals. But underlying all of that is working with the right people. Sometimes people will come to us. It's the funniest thing. They'll say, guys, we really need a very, very tight agreement. We need to make sure that there's no loopholes in this joint venture agreement or co-development agreement, mm-hmm. because I really don't trust my partner, or I really don't trust the company that we're working with. And I say to them, that's ridiculous. We can't write you a contract that somebody won't challenge. I mean, even if it's as tight as we can make it, somebody can always take a run at it. So we can't protect you from a bad relationship or from someone that you don't want to work with or that you don't trust. So choose your partner well. I think that's the underlying message here. And then the agreement gives you that common framework and structure from which the two companies can work. So you work together. You refer back to the division of responsibilities, as Byron's described, that the statement of work or scope of work, and whenever something comes up, an issue comes up, hey, how do we deal with change? Well, we've got a roadmap in the agreement. So the agreement becomes a way to maintain a good relationship, but it's not a fix for a bad relationship, if you get that point. So choose your partner well. And then do an agreement that allows you then to have that common framework going forward as a way of maintaining, not creating the relationship.
Yeah, no, I think that's some really good advice, right? Like, basically, take a look at who you're working with. If you feel like there's going to be issues, maybe that's not the best partner to have. You know, right. Contracts are there to stipulate inevitable, like, eventualities that you couldn't foresee, not protect you from bad right. relationships. Completely
right.
makes sense.
A bad relationship. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay, great. I have another question here. You kind of touched on it a little bit about in the addendum, but the question is, if I'm working with or done a license agreement with an owner of work, and it turns out that owner loses a copyright battle with another party, does that mean that the license agreement that I have worked out with the party, does that get nulled? And who really owns the copyright at that point?
So you're in difficulty there, and I think Byron talked about it touched on it in terms of indemnity. So when you're working with other people and they're bringing intellectual property to you, right? So this in the example you've described, as I understand it, somebody's brought the intellectual property, the concept, to you. You work on it together. You have an agreement with that person on how you're going to share the proceeds of exploiting that copyright or that intellectual property. Turns out they don't own the intellectual property. You know, first of all, your agreement should say both parties should warrant. It's called warranty. That basically they promise. I promise you that I actually own this this intellectual property. That's the first thing. The second thing you say in those agreements is, if I'm wrong about that and somebody takes a run at me and it turns out I don't own the intellectual property and you suffer loss as a result, I will indemnify you. That means I'll be responsible for it. Again, this is picking your partners well. Do you trust the partner? Does the partner take that seriously? The warranty that they're making, and secondly, if they are wrong and you do suffer damage, are they good for it? Do they have the money to actually fulfill their indemnity? Or then they say, well, geez, you know what? I agreed to indemnify you. So sorry, but I actually don't have any money or any resources. So that's too bad. So, you know, as the partner, you're not going to be able to acquire any rights in intellectual property that they don't have. So in the scenario you describe, I would suggest that the most likely outcome is you're both out of luck. The party that owned the intellectual property is going to keep it, and you know, you're going to be forced to look at your partner to be indemnified for any loss as a result of that. Or, you know, the other thing is, you go to the party that actually does own the intellectual property, and you say, hey, you know what? I really like your property. I've got some great ideas for how we could build a game around it. And why don't you and I do a deal? So there's more than one way to solve the problem. But I think the simple answer is you don't get anything if you know your partner doesn't have anything to give.
Mm-hmm. Another comment, Mickey, is that if your partner is a company that's run by, let's say, one principal person, you may want to have your agreement with them be personally guaranteed by that principal, because the company may not have any assets, but the person might.
Right.
But as Mark alluded to, if the person doesn't have any assets, you know, you're kind of out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's a great point, Mickey, because a lot of the people we're going to be, you know, we may be talking to in this interview and that we deal with, you know, are relatively small game developers. And so, you know, they're two individuals who know each other, and two individuals are going to work together, but they actually also have companies. And so the agreements are between their companies. Now, from a legal perspective, it's the companies that are in a contractual relationship. But from a psychological or relational perspective, it's actually two individuals who are working with each other, and they're relying on each other to do things, and they expect each other as individuals to be responsible. And so what Byron is suggesting, and I totally agree, is that in that situation, you would want to have your contract between the companies actually include either the two individuals as signatories to the contract or as guarantors of the contract. And again, that's just one line at the bottom of the contract saying, you know, I'm the sole owner of Company X, who's a party to this contract, and I hereby guarantee all of the obligations of the company under the agreement. And then the contract is really reflecting the underlying reality of the relationship, and that is that you're looking to each other as individuals, even though the agreement is in the name of your companies. Because typically the companies are shells in any event. They have very limited assets.
Well, it makes sense. It gives you extra security. Sure. And kind of all this kind of topic kind of leads me into my last section here that I want to touch on, and that's the exploitation of your product, right? Making money from your games and how it basically handle that. So we talked a little bit about license agreements. I've also heard the term assignments thrown around. So what's the difference between an assignment and a license?
Sure. Well, at its core, the assignment, you're giving a legal entitlement of your game to someone else. Licensing, it's a much, you're giving permission to use the game within defined parameters. So for example, you're giving a license for a distributor to distribute your game for 2 years in Canada on digital platforms. Much more defined.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and Byron's given a good example of it. It's, you know, copyright, as we talked earlier, is a bundle of rights. It's the right to reproduce, exploit, distribute. It's in different languages in different territories for different purposes, etc. It's a whole group of rights, and an assignment basically takes that whole ball of rights or bundle of rights and transfers it to somebody else. And you, as the assignor, have nothing left. Maybe you have a revenue right to a revenue stream or whatever, but you have nothing left in that bundle of rights. Whereas licensing is like slicing. You say, okay, you take that slice, you take that slice. You can use my intellectual property on one distribution channel. Somebody else can use it on another. You can use my intellectual property, let's say, to create a graphic novel, or you can create a film or a television product from that. So you're slicing the rights up. You still own the bundle, but you're just giving others the right to use different aspects of that intellectual property, or to use it in particular ways, usually for a particular period of time. And when that's over, it comes back to you. So basic difference is, you know, transferring the whole bundle and piecing it out.
So you should be careful if you're a game developer and someone's asking you to assign the rights if you think that they're only getting a very specific use. So just be careful if you know when that word comes up.
Yeah, it basically boils down to how you want to get that revenue stream, right? Do you want to just have a one-time payout, or are you looking for something that's going to be continuous, and licensing gives you the continuous, whereas the assignment is just a one-time payout, right?
Right. Makes sense. You know, you can, when instead of the word assignment, think, you know, sell. I'm going to sell the game. And when I sell the game's gone. Whatever I get, in that sales transaction is all I'm ever going to get. I mean, that sales transaction might include a revenue stream or a revenue share over time, but basically that deal is my deal. Whereas licensing gives you, opportunities to exploit it in many, many different ways with a variety of partners.
Awesome. Okay, so I have one more question around exploitation, and then I want to open up. We got some really good questions coming in through chat, and before we wrap up, I want to get to those. But my last question around the exploitation part of it is, so we know about the licensing and the assignment part of it. What other considerations should I think about when I start to approach a publisher or start to work with store sites, say something like the Windows Store or Steam? What are the considerations to worry about when I'm looking at a situation like that?
Yeah, so let me throw out a couple, and Byron can add a couple. You want to understand what the terms of that particular site or distribution channel are. Key things you typically look at is exclusivity. You got to figure out whether they're by putting your product on or in that channel, you are giving up the opportunity to place it in other channels. So In an ideal world, everything would be, non-exclusive. But if the price is right, and if you feel that the channel is vulnerable enough, you may grant them exclusive rights, and so you wouldn't exploit the game in other channels. Because this is licensing, you can slice and dice it. So you say it's exclusive. We were talking to a guy recently on who's got a VR product, and he's looking at making it exclusive on one of the VR platforms for 6 months or 12 months, and then it becomes non-exclusive. So you can define the timing of that. Another thing, obviously, you want to know what the fee is, what the compensation structure is. If you're getting a revenue share, for example, is it a rev share based on gross? Am I getting 30% of gross sales? Am I getting 30% of net sales? If I'm getting net sales, what are you deducting before we get to that number? So gross might be a dollar, and then is the net sales in which I'm going to share, is it going to be 25% less or 50% less? What expenses are you taking or deductions from gross to get to net? So the definition of your compensation is very, very important.
Something else on compensation is when you're actually getting paid, so the payment schedule. Look in the agreement to see on what intervals you're getting paid. For example, it might say you get paid annually, but you're expecting for cash flow to get paid on a monthly or quarterly basis. But a good way to better understand the deal is to look at the frequently asked questions that hopefully exist on the site. Those are the questions that you may not have thought of, that someone else has thought of, right, and oftentimes will lead to some other questions. And then just look in the Google the store and look to see what other people are saying in different chat rooms or different blogs about it.
Yeah, these agreements can be 20, 30 pages long. I mean, who clicks on the license terms? I don't click on the license.
I don't think I've ever read one in my life, to be quite honest.
They're crazy complicated. They take 2 or 3 hours to read anyway. The easiest way to do that, I'm going to get sued for this, but really, like we always do, we look to the community. You go into the blogs, you say, who's spent some time thinking about this? What kinds of problems have people had? The calculation of the fees, an appropriate fee structure, timing of payments, exclusivity. Do they own the intellectual property? Are they getting any rights in the intellectual property? And some of these deals, when you contribute intellectual property or your game or you make a contribution to somebody else's game content, they own it. You upload user content, they own it. In other cases, they may not own it, but they may have the right to use it and make derivative products. So to essentially copy it and use it in other contexts. So, whenever you're participating in these things, it is important to understand, what the basic deal is, and really as a starting point, I'd use the FAQs and then what the community is saying about the deal with that particular publisher or storefront.
Yeah, I think that's some really good advice there. Like, basically just reach out to the community, see what they're saying, go through those channels, like check out on the Steam site. I'm sure there's a lot of good content there because it does boil down to certain circumstances. Just because we are running out of time here, I'm just going to jump to a couple of questions that we got in chat. One, we kind of touched this in the copyright stuff, but if a sound is taken from another game, does it have to be heavily edited so not to sound like the original, or should you seek out to license that sound?
Well, so this is, this isn't just sounds in other games. I mean, individual sounds are going to be pretty difficult to, it's not likely you're going to have copyright issues very, very, very brief individual sounds. They may be trademarks. There may be a particular sound that is so closely identified in the public mind with a particular game that it actually becomes associated in the with that game and only with that game. So you may have a trademark issue, but You know, generally the use of sound or music in games is subject to the same you know, copying rules as apply to music in another context. The point is that when you use another's, you know, someone else's intellectual property, whether it's you know, it's taking it from you know, a popular artist, you know, an MP3 you download off the internet, or you pull it out of somebody else's game, you still, you know, you have the same issue. Somebody owns that, and if you're using a you know, a recognizable phrase, you know, a few bars of it, really you have to get permission. You have to get permission from the performer, whether it's the you know, the singer or the musician. You have to get if it's a song, you have to get permission from the author of the song. And sometimes, I mean, music can be hard. It can be both lyrics and music, and two different authors and two different copyrights. And obviously at that point you're using somebody else's master recording. You know, I mean, music is a whole different. And you know, complicated subject, because music does have so many contributors, mm-hmm. and so a piece of recorded music, a song, is, you know, there's copyright in the lyrics, there's copyright in the music, there's copyright in the performance, and there's copyright in the recording. So somebody owns the recording.
It's much like game development, right? When you think about that, all the pieces that go into the game development, yeah. is the same as the music. So that's right. Good advice, right? If you think that, you know, if you're going to use music or someone's, like, you know, edited work, make sure that you reach out to the owner.
Right.
If it's a tone or something, like, you know, like a single, you know, 3600 tone, I don't think that's something you really need to worry about, but makes sense. Last question that we got coming out of chat is, I really like this one. If you release a version of software to public domain, so you make it available for free to the public, does that mean that it's impossible to restrict further use on newer versions or anything along those lines?
You know, I mean, if you publish something under a GPU, either, you know, a general public use license or a lesser GPU, you got to live with the terms of that license. And basically what you're doing is you're putting that software into the world under that license. And anybody in the world has the right to use that software in accordance with that license. You have now, you know, you're subject to that license, and everybody who uses it subsequent to you is subject to that license. So
be very careful before you decide to go public.
I mean, that's a huge issue. Sure, mm-hmm. like you wouldn't. You gotta give some serious thought to that before you make your software available under a public license. Now, under a general public license. You've got to be careful, because you can actually, by including open source or publicly licensed software with your privately licensed or proprietary software, you can actually create something. You can lose your proprietary rights in the software if they become mixed.
So be very, make sure that you check the licensing of every product that you're using inside of your own product, because it might change the licensing of yours.
That's some
really good advice.
Very true. And understand the difference between the lesser general public license, public use license, and the general public use license, because they are different. And you can lose rights in your own software by combining them with general public use license.
Yeah, make sure you do lots of research around that. That's great. Well, we're running out of time, guys. Thank you so much. Thanks again to Byron and Mark from Edwards PC Creative Law. Fantastic. You know, all these topics are so deep. We could sit here for days and just keep talking. I don't think really cover anything. But you've given us some really, really good advice. We're game developers. We're good with that. We just take some more Red Bull. but no, it's been a really an eye opener. Like, I've learned a lot myself. And moving forward, I know that, you know, as it gets complicated, it's probably a good idea to give someone like you guys a call. So thank you very much for joining us today and sharing all your knowledge. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Our pleasure, Mickey.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, everyone. Hopefully you found this entertaining and enlightening. So can't wait to chat some more. Happy coding.